Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. And in the studio today, we've got co-host this week of Russ Chianelli. We have a guest who's ex-Shell. His name is Dave Steele, and he spent a 30-year career at Shell doing exploration for hydrocarbons and all the rest of it. And so it's going to be an interesting program because discovery of oil, looking for oil, getting oil, extracting oil, it's a big deal these days, especially out here in far west Texas. So, Dave, welcome to Science Studio.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So before we get into the program, why don't we learn a little bit about your background? Did you start out always wanting to be a geologist? I mean, how did you get into this as a career?
Well, my folks told me when I was a kid, I just would always bring rocks back in my pockets, and my mother ran them through the washing machine. So evidently, as a child, I was always interested in rocks. Grew up in Michigan, and there were a lot of different kinds of rocks to look at because in the glacial outwash, we had everything from the Precambrian through the Paleozoic, and it was all right there.
I don't know much about the geology of Michigan, except that's one of the rare places in the world where you can actually find native pure copper.
Yeah,
there was a Native American tribe there that used to use it.
There's copper in the Upper Peninsula along Keweenaw Bay, and there's diamonds as well, if you're really lucky.
You mean just laying around?
Well, they're in the glacial outwash. They've been scraped down from Canada. In school, I had a wonderful teacher in the sixth grade who inspired me to want to be an elementary school teacher, and I gave that a try. I got my teaching certificate from Michigan State, and I taught for a year and a half, and I found out elementary education was not going to be my calling. So I was there was either chaos in the classrooms or I was making the kids cry. So we never hit the happy medium.
But how long did you go through the process before you found that out?
Well, that was I finished my degree and found that out.
Oh no, but it was just in the practice teaching you found this out.
Yeah, that was so the internship was after you finish your degree and you're a teacher. So I had to start all over again. So I went from elementary education, I sold sporting goods for a year to try to figure out what my next step was. And I thought it was time to go back and face all my science and math deficiencies. So basically, even though I had a undergraduate degree, I had to start over and do all my math, all my chemistry, all my physics, and start geology.
When did you know it was the right thing, finally?
Well, that's a really good question because I was getting really worried. I was 3 years into my second undergrad before I found an aspect of geology that really interested me, and that was depositional systems. So I had a fantastic sedimentology professor. He brought geology alive in a way that no other instructor had, even though I had a lot of really good instructors. But his theme was every rock tells a story, and you just have to decode the story by what's in the rock. And so that's really what I spent a career doing.
And once you've got the first degree, did you go straight to work?
Yeah. Well, then after I finished my second undergraduate degree, I went to at Western Michigan, I went to the University of Texas at Arlington and to work on my graduate degree.
Then finally got a job.
And then I finally got a job. Yeah, so it was a lot of years of school, and I ended up at Shell through the contacts at the university. That was around 1980-ish, and I graduated in 1982 when oil was going to $100 in the first cycle. So it was very much a boom cycle. And there were lots of opportunities. So I chose Shell because at the time I thought I liked the whole management of Shell and their culture. And their culture was stated by an HR person that said, "We hired all PhDs and master's candidates, and because we expect our any Shell person to work on a wide range of problems. And so if you're working out in the division, If you encounter a problem that needs further investigation, we want people to be able to go from the division to the research center and pursue those problems and then back again. And no other company really had that kind of outlook. And that sounded really exciting to me. And before I knew it, I was hired in the Rocky Mountain Exploration Division. And before I knew it, I had my first transfer, and it was to Shell Research. So actually, before I even started in the Rocky Mountain group, I
you got a problem straight away that you have to go to research.
And I spent my first 5 years working research and then went out to the division.
Did you? And then you went back to the Rocky Mountains, and you solved the problem that you came up with, or not?
No, my I ended up working the Gulf Coast, onshore Texas, and that was fun. That was kind of a natural outgrowth of the work I was doing at the research lab. And after that, I went. I had a posting for a number of years doing international assignments. Then went back to the research center for a second tour. And then ended up going back to international exploration after that.
So if I was to say that the focus of that career has been exploration, is that a reasonable place to begin the conversation? What is exploration for oil, and is it going to carry on and on and on, and we've got unlimited reserves forever and ever and ever?
Yeah, I work primarily new ventures. Where do we find new oil? And that was really the focus of my exploration work as well.
You know, a few years ago, the Wall Street Journal said that when you take United States, Mexico, Canada, the Gulf, we are the new Middle East. We're producing so much right now.
Yeah, well, the unconventionals are working. Certainly, you know, with the billions of dollars that have been poured into exploration, I think we're finding that unconventionals don't work across the board.
Just explain what unconventionals mean for our listener.
Well, conventional oil and gas is you're able to put a well in the ground, and hydrocarbons will flow to the well and to the surface pretty much under their own pressure. With unconventionals, you have to do something to the rock, generally by fracking, to make hydrocarbons flow through the subsurface and into the well.
Everybody has heard about fracking. Even people in Southeast England are worried about hydraulic fracturing, destroying the bucolic beauty of certain parts of England. But the implication is that unconventionals, as fracking been going on a long time, and just we didn't know about it, we the lay public.
Because Exxon and Shell were doing it for 40, 50 years.
Yeah, the first I encountered fracking was when I was working the Wilcox Formation in Texas. And they had been fracking wells since the 70s. And typically, fracking is going on down at 15,000 feet below the surface. So it's much deeper than where potable water is. And certainly you have millions of wells that have drilled through potable water.
So over the 40 or 50 years of fracking that the companies have been doing, there is no example of any bad things happening, really.
There's been a lot of fracking. I mean, accidents happen in any industry. You can have casing failures. You have to dispose of the frack water. And I think most of what we see in the news is problems with disposal of wastewater. And that is an issue.
And I mean, there are papers that have come out over the last few years from researchers at UT Arlington. In fact, Hildenbrand is the main author, showing, in fact, that the water, well water, for the people living close to where hydraulic fracking is taking place, near Fort Worth and in that particular region, are full of materials that can only come from some chemical transformation of their water supply because of what's going on in the fracturing. So I mean, it's not that there are no issues at all. There are some issues. They don't quite know how to solve them. They don't know quite how they come about. But it's very unambiguous that when some of these fracking wells go in, and after a certain time, the quality of the well water for the people living there deteriorates with things like benzene, for goodness sake, methanol. Right? So I don't know what the materials are they put down for fracturing, but it's proprietary anyway. Nobody knows what people are putting down in there with the lubricants and the things of that nature. So there are issues there. It's not all just peaches and cream. And then all these earthquakes they've been having in Oklahoma, I think that's very clearly associated with deep well formations and fracturing.
Yeah, in Oklahoma, that's the wastewater is being injected in a formation that sits right on the basement. And that wastewater is lubricating the basement faults.
That has to be a problem to be addressed. Send those people back to the research lab. How do you do it better?
Yeah, you have to find another formation that will take the wastewater.
Well, you know, an interesting point about that, in the 80s when I was working with various people, there were scientists at Berkeley that wanted to put fracking fluids down into the faults to make the big earthquakes, go slowly. If you can make the faults slip, you avoid the big earthquakes. So the question was, is fracking causing the small ones on the East Coast or preventing the big ones on the West Coast? And that's still an issue today.
In California, where you want easy strain release on the big faults, that seems
yeah,
to
but
make
we've
sense.
Done program with seismologists and people who are into the whole business of faults and earthquakes, and they said that there's no way that you can control it so nicely. It sounds wonderful, you know. You put a little bit of grease, and all of it, they begin to slide. He said, Keith.
Well, that's not what the scientists at Berkeley, who are very well famous, were doing. And say you would have to do it along a long thing. It's just like lubricating something that's cracking. So it's an open question. That could be a good one. And now that we've had some recent earthquakes in Ecuador and so on and so forth, I think it's something that we ought to think about.
You're listening to Science Studio. This is Keith Pannell along with Russ Chianelli and Dave Steele, an ex-Shell employee who has been very important in going out there and discovering new sources of hydrocarbon for a career. We'll be back in one moment. Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Russ Chianelli, Dave Steele, an ex-employee of Shell, who spent a career in exploration, finding new sources of hydrocarbon, not just in Texas and the USA, but around the world. And so, Dave, tell us, bring us up to date. We're all going through this agony of seeing a lot of people in, say, West Texas, Permian Basin area, losing jobs. Production is going up rather than going down, which is sort of interesting. Where do you see the current situation stabilizing? You must be a bit of an expert in this.
One thing we know that we can't do is predict where the price of oil is going to go, and we're very much in one of those cycles right now. It's being driven by global politics more than the economy. And so if you can predict what's in the minds of the Saudis, you'll be able to predict where this trend is going to go.
So the Saudi reserves then are still the major dominant feature in the international oil business?
Oh, yeah.
But, I mean, just before the break, Russell was saying that North America is the new Middle East and that we've got more supplies. So why is the Saudi – is it because it's so cheap for them to produce?
Yeah, our production costs are double or triple what the Saudis are. So we're producing a lot of oil, thank goodness. It's important to the security of our nation. But the Saudis can produce it at $20 and less.
So they can, in fact, starve out the other people over a period of 5-10 years?
Seems to be their intent.
All right.
Yeah, and, another related question to that is maybe 10, 15 years ago, journals were publishing that we're running out of oil. There's not much left. And then you read another one that says we got, at our current use, enough for 1,000 years, okay, and we're the new Middle East. So why don't you comment a little bit about how long we think these reserves will last?
That would be outside of my pay grade, really. So we've seen a technology jump in the U.S., and certainly the U.S. is on the forefront of using new technology to get reserves out of the subsurface that were previously unrecoverable. And we know that fracking is the tool that does that enables the release of hydrocarbons to move from the subsurface into a wellbore so it can be produced. And we also see a natural decline in our reserves of conventional hydrocarbons that don't require fracking. So the recovery of these unconventional hydrocarbons is solely dependent on the new technologies and being sustained by high prices. Otherwise, you can't afford to use the technology. So our reserves are very much dependent on new technology and high oil prices.
And what do you call high?
Well, you know, the general figure used for unconventional production is someplace around $50 to $60 a barrel as a break-even point. And there are some places that, you know, in terms of the industry, they're called sweet spots, kind of where everything works really well at much lower prices. Those are being exploited now.
But the technology comes into that also, because I was listening on the radio recently that the number of wells or new wells that are being created, or rigs creating wells in the Midland Odessa region, this year is half what it was last year, except the production is almost 15-20% higher.
Yeah.
So the efficiency with which the industry is extracting must be, you know, on a really big incline.
Yeah, there are horizontal wells, multilateral wells, where you go out in multiple directions from a single well bore. It's all part of the new game.
You know, there's one part of it that we haven't discussed yet, and that is that I don't think people realize it's something like 12 to 24 million tons of oil squirted naturally into the sea from the vents. And the vents are these wells that are, you know, on the continental shelf that, you know, can do 50,000 barrels a day, so they're called giants. It costs more to get down there, but maybe you could comment a little bit on the offshore well giants.
Are you talking about natural seeps or
natural seeps? Yeah,
yeah. Well, that's one of the things in new ventures that we use to try to open up new basins. There's been various technologies used to try to identify natural oil seeps, from satellites to low-flying aircraft, bouncing lasers off the ocean surface and looking at how the light returns to a sensor. One of the areas that we were particularly successful in is offshore Nigeria. And offshore Nigeria has a lot of very large structures that are dewatering. Brines are coming out of the top of the structures, and along with the brines, oil and gas is coming as well. So when you're in new ventures, you like to see things that look like that, because if it's coming to the surface, there's still some left in the subsurface.
So is that now a commercial source of hydrocarbons?
Offshore Nigeria, it's billions of
barrels.
I
mean, the natural seeps, the giants, as Russell pointed out.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
So we can harness that and do separations. Are the separations done under the water, or do they bring all this mix to the surface?
Well, that's Mother Nature. So nobody's really trying to skim natural seeps yet.
And okay.
So that's just going to the surface of the
Well, were you still with Shell when the Macondo oil spill happened? That was a deep seep kind of operation.
Yeah, well, that was a blowout. So that was entirely man-made.
Yeah. But were you still there when that happened?
Yes.
Did you hear those stories about how the oil was destroying the oysters on the coast?
That, by anybody's reckoning, was a tremendous disaster.
The oysters were destroyed because the people on the coast were washing them with fresh water, which kills them, and the oil doesn't.
Oh.
You drive through Texas. I'm sure you do. Maybe you drove to come here. I often go through, and I'm always amazed over the transformation over the last 10, 15 years, whereas before I'd go through Midland, Odessa, and then through Sweetwater, and, you know, it was all oil, and you could smell it all the way through, and now you've got these big windmills out there. And Texas is, in fact, leading the nation in many ways on diversifying its energy sources. Solar is going out through the roof, windmills. Do you see a time when we can simply use hydrocarbons for more important things than just burning and fuel?
Well, I think that's, I would love to see that. You know, we just have one Earth, and It does have a set of finite energy sources, so I'm all for alternative energy types.
Well, that's not quite the answer I was looking for. We're all for it, but do you think we should be really making a bigger effort to go there, rather than just saying, well, it's a great idea, let's just incorporate it? Should there be more of an emphasis on this?
Well, right now, for that emphasis, it has to be funded. And so when oil is at $100 a barrel, then some of these alternative fuels make a lot more economic sense because they can compete with the price of oil. When oil's at $20 a barrel or $40 a barrel, they don't compete unless they're subsidized. So then it becomes kind of a national focus on, do we want to put tax dollars at work to fund more expensive energy sources because we don't want to pursue oil and gas that's cheaper? You know, so far in terms of coal, as a nation, we've kind of already gone the direction. Now we want to regulate coal production so severely that it can't be produced economically.
Well, a good example is biofuels, which we could talk about a little bit. And what happened is that, you know, a few years ago was hot, and then the biofuel industry began to use soybean oil or something, and the question was food or fuel, which do you want?
Yeah. Yeah, when oil and gas is this cheap, all of those alternatives, they just don't make sense. And wind is fantastic in Texas. I think for at 1 a.m. last week, wind power generated enough energy to fuel Texas's needs for 1 hour when a cold front came through.
Right.
So those little spikes, you know, they're at this point they're curiosities, but I won't be surprised to see that grow over the next 20 years, where it's meeting more than 10-20% of our energy needs.
I'd be remiss in this program if I've got two experts from the oil industry on my left and on my right. Let's talk about just a little bit global warming. I mean, I think that everybody now is on the same page that there is a climate change happening, all right? When you find that champagne manufacturers in France are buying land in England to grow their champagne grapes because the weather in France is just too warm, too much sugar, and the champagne isn't as good of quality, you know something is happening. So from your point of view of a career in the oil industry, how do you respond to people who say, look, all of this oil, when it's consumed, goes to CO2. Some people say the CO2 is irrelevant to climate warming. Others say it's the direct cause. What's your feeling for this? And what your background knowledge and having studied this area for a career, how do you discuss that to your grandchildren, for example?
Well, if I was to answer as a scientist, first of all, I'd say this is outside of my personal and scientific experience. I've never done any climate modeling. Like anyone else, I can sit back and say, gee, glaciers are melting. That's a fact. We have a greater occurrence of severe storms. So particularly in the last 10 years. And so I don't think you'll find that many people that don't agree that the climate is changing and that it's warming. The issue seems to be more what's causing it. You know, as a geologist, I can look back at the last 500,000 years and I can see the previous glacial cycles. We're coming off a glacial cycle that started warming about 15,000 years ago. And if I look, and they occur at a frequency of about every 100,000 years. So when I look at the last five, I can say that every one of them had interglacial temperatures that are warmer than today. And that as the glaciers melted, they went to these higher temperatures extremely fast.
That's what I gather, right.
And that's recorded in the ice cores. So what the climate modelers are doing is to try to use data like that and lots of other diverse kinds of data and say, okay, what's the climate's signature in these natural Earth cycles versus what's the impact of the CO2 that's being released by burning of fossil fuels? And that's really where the question is, and that question has been open for debate. So is the warming due to man burning fossil fuels, or is it due more to this natural cycle that's going to occur?
In those natural cycles, have people been able, by all sorts of isotopes and all the rest of it, to study the amount of CO2 that was in the atmosphere during those warming periods back in other glacial warming periods?
Yeah, so one source of CO2 in nature is from volcanoes.
Yeah.
And so you look back and you say, well, where were the volcanoes that are tied to all these cycles? And you don't find them. So then what's the source of the CO2? A lot of the thinking, as I understand it, not being an expert in that specific field, is that a lot of it is tied up in the Arctic. So you have extensive permafrost that's tying up a lot of organic matter that was laid down during the warm cycles. And as that thaws, that CO2 is released to the atmosphere.
The implication is that during those warming periods, there was again an increased amount of CO2 in those old atmospheres.
Yeah, so you have, as the permafrost thaws during the warming cycles, the CO2 is released from the rotting.
But you know, the thing that's missing from this conversation, and I say this all the time, is the heater, the sun. What is the sun doing over that period?
According to the National Solar Observatory, DAMOL, it's been pretty constant. We've had the director of the National Solar Observatory on this program, and he said, look, that's not an issue.
Yeah.
But what is an issue is that we've run out of time. So Dave Steele, ex-Shell Exploration, it's been delightful to have you here. And thank you for listening out there, and we'll be back next week with another Science Studio. Bye-bye.